Hello and welcome to the EV Cafe Takeaway, that podcast that's focused on a zero emission future that we all hope for. Yeah, absolutely. And every week we are joined by one of the wonderful EV Cafe team in this conversation. And that this week is the wonderful John Curtis JC.
Now then, I'm feeling a bit uncomfortable today. I think I might have a case of the wind.
Oh, well, nobody needs a case of the wind, do we? Unless, of course, you're our next guest. And our next guest needs lots of wind. And that is an innovator, a pioneer, truly a pioneer in really clever stuff. And a collaborator because he loves to bring everybody in. It's John Farley, everybody, is Managing Director of AW Energy. He's going to correct me anyway. But tell us, John, who are you and where are you from?
Hello, good afternoon, and thank you very much for that wonderful introduction. Yes, I'm John Farley, Managing Director of AW Energy, part of the Arnold White Group, and I'm responsible for developing onshore wind projects, solar projects, and EV charging stations. So hello there.
Fantastic. And John, we've already identified yourself as a very kind human being because you didn't correct me on the pronunciation of your surname. Well done. So John Farley is fair. John, it's exciting because you told me a story once about the speed of progress in your industry. And tell me that story again, because you focus on really, very much so onshore wind. I know there's other things as well. And you gave me a wonderful example of how it's progressed in the last 30 years since that first onshore. Give our listeners just a sense of the scale of change in the onshore wind generation world.
Well, it's around 30 years ago now, maybe just a bit longer, when the first onshore wind farm was developed in the UK. That was a site called Delabole in Cornwall. And that site had 10 400 kilowatt wind turbines on it. So it generated a maximum amount of 4 megawatts worth of energy. Now it was 34 years ago. Nowadays, if you buy a single turbine, so the turbine, for example, that we put up last year, that's a 4.1 megawatt turbine, and that single machine will generate more than the 10 machines that were put up 30 years ago. And that's an incredible difference. And even now, that machine is starting to be considered a baby. We're now starting to see 5 megawatt turbines, 6 megawatts. I think Enercon put up a 7 megawatt turbine last month in Germany.
My goodness. It's
remarkable how the industry moves.
It really is. And so for context, everybody, John and I have both experienced this wonderful... Oh, John, actually, have you experienced it? Did you come to the site, Checkley Wood?
Now, I've been to Checkley Wood. The first time I came was when I was on the EV rally. And so we called in with 50 electric vehicles, including a truck, a number of trucks, in fact, and large vans and so on, just rocked up, massive turbine. And what I love about Checkley Wood is that for anybody who doesn't understand how EVs should work, this is perfection. Mm. You have a line of sight between energy generation, big turbine whirring round, creating energy, straight through to chargers and into vehicles. It is the simplest way of showing exactly how EV can work effectively. But not only that, the people on the ground were fantastic. They were so hospitable, helped everybody with their charging. There's a Starbucks, so happy days for me. It was just brilliant. So yes, I've been to Checkley Wood and love it.
I'm glad to hear that. I mean, the idea of what we're trying to achieve is on-site generation straight to the retail, straight to the consumer.
Yeah.
So that there's no doubt about where the green energy is coming from. You can see it when you're charging. You know where it's coming from, which is good to hear.
And John, what gave you that idea in the first place? Because I'm right in thinking, and we don't want to tempt fate here, but I think it's a world first. Possibly world, but certainly European. Yeah, and if not, maybe UK. And if not, definitely Elaine Buzzard.
Definitely Elaine Buzzard. No, we believe from a wind perspective it is. There's a fantastic project that GridServe did, Solar to Wheel, down in Cornwall. The new site at Winchester, the super hub there, which has solar battery and an EV there. But we believe from a wind perspective, this is the first time that it's been done. And it's one of those things where over the years working in the wind industry, generally you would develop a wind farm, you plug it in, check if everything's working, and that's your job done. And one of the issues that the wind industry has had over the years, and it's similar to anything else, is the disconnect between what we do and the end user, the public. Yeah. Yeah. And people need to understand where their power is coming from. And we do find that when we put up turbines, people will say, "Well, that's my turbine. It's the landmark, the local landmark." But actually... Actually having the output of that usefully going into something that is visible makes a huge difference, and it makes a huge difference in the acceptability of the projects as well. And that's something which, as an industry, the industry is very good at developing wind farms and very good at progressing in the renewables agenda, but that link between generation and supply is very, very rare, and that's what we were trying to achieve with this site.
Because I think that's really key. And if you think about it, organic food, 10 years ago, people would say, oh, organic, you just pay a lot more for the same old stuff, or, you know, it's grown without fertilizer, big deal. And when they started to understand the journey that your produce goes through with all the chemicals that are put in and all that stuff, you get to a point where you say, I want to eat cleaner, better, reared locally. You start to understand the mechanics of it and you make more informed decisions and then can justify paying an additional price. The trick with you, however, is that not only do you do all the beautifulness, but you do it cheaper than other retailers.
And that's very important to us. When we set out on this journey, originally, we were looking at what we could do with a wind turbine. I mean, originally, back in the sort of 2000, from 2010 onwards, a lot of wind was supported by something called the feed-in tariff. Mm. And that is a structure that allows the funding of new capital projects by having an extra tariff on top of the wholesale cost of electricity. And we sat there and we thought, well, projects don't have this anymore. What can we do that's different? And we thought about how to make that link between generation and retail. But then actually, when you do that, you can share the benefit. So because we have wind and EV on the same site operating together, we can bring the price down substantially for the end user. So the cost of an ultra rapid charge at Checkley Wood is 39 pence a kilowatt hour. Now, from the public's perspective, it's brilliant. We believe we're the cheapest on the market for that sort of charge. But also from our perspective, it means that we can retail a portion of our turbine power directly taking the network out of it. So it's a win-win situation, really. And it's also, from a pricing perspective, we believe the right thing to do. We wouldn't have felt comfortable operating at a higher price because of the way we integrated the project. We didn't need to. So it's definitely something we're very proud of. Mm.
And absolutely rightly so. It kind of feels like the farm shop, almost like the farmer produces lots of apples and carrots and potatoes and all that sort of stuff. And they sell them off to the big conglomerates that sort of want to put it out at 20p a potato or whatever it is. But actually, you're saying, no, we're not going to go to the grid who will pay us X. Mm-hmm. We're going to go to the retailer. But in this instance, the retailer is getting a much better deal
exactly.
than having to go, you know, and so you're winning. So the net effect of this, John, for you as a business, right? So with your business head on, and I'm sure somebody in finance has scrutinized this closely, has it been a success for you? Has it driven the right messaging? Are you getting the utilization that you want to get from the site to make it profitable?
We're still month on month growing. Our utilization is increasing rapidly. And what we consider a bad day now was an exceptional day before we set the 39 pence price. We are delighted with it. And what we also find is that it isn't just passing traffic. We're getting quite a lot of local customers, customers who don't necessarily have at-home charging, but now they have a charging station nearby that is affordable. They can make that decision now to move to EV without having a home charger. And we had that just last week. My colleague was on site talking to a guy who just bought a new Polestar, and he was utterly delighted. He didn't have anywhere to plug in at home, but he felt that he was getting good value plugging in it at Checkley Wood. So it's working really well in that sense.
John, it's really brave. I mean, if you think about it, as a business person, you had options. You put in all this infrastructure and you were generating income. You could have said, well, we'll do this for a period of time. We'll drop the price for a month to get people aware of the fact that we are generating this energy here and draw in people. And if you'd kept the utilization rates high, you might have been able to reduce your payback period so that you'd have paid for the infrastructure much quicker than other retailers. But you've been really brave and said, you know what? No, we're going to slash that price in half.
Yeah.
And we're going to give that value to the customer. Are you naturally a very brave person like that?
I would say it's more a reflection of the company as a wider as a wider issue. I mean, we have a wonderful family who own and back the company. It's still a family owned firm and a board with a vision, and it's all part of the wider vision that we're trying to achieve. So I mentioned before we started. Another part of the business is a development arm, and that development arm promotes new housing schemes and new communities on previously restored quarry land. We're also quarry operators, but what we're trying to achieve with that, our next project incorporates housing, school, a large wind turbine, a solar farm, a large EV charging station, all brought together with a micro grid that will allow us to essentially power the new residents, the new community with clean energy. And as a company, we see clean energy communities as the way forward and the responsible way to develop new housing schemes. So all of it really is part of a vision, but also a wider vision, because if we're able to do that with an EV charging station connected to a large turbine, and we translate that to a new community, that new community should have secure, cheap, renewable power as well. And this is the sort of model that we're trying to put together. So it is brave, but at the same time, it's all part of a wider picture and a model that we really believe in. And where we're not looking at clean energy communities, where we're looking at more EV charging station sites, they will always be integrated with new renewable technology. The idea is to keep those together, to be softer on the grid, and to allow us to demonstrate to the public where their energy is coming from.
Amazing.
It is fantastic. I love the future that you guys represent and are bringing to us. And I'd like to explore that a bit more, but so that to help people understand. But before we go too far ahead,
yeah,
I want to get into how you got, because I mean, you know, this is, it's an interesting world, right? The renewable world. Mm-hmm. How did you get into it? And also, I want to explore the fact that you've been quite involved with all of this over the last few years. You've done rather a lot. So I'd like to explore that too. But tell me how you first you got here.
Well, back, gosh, going back to the mid-1990s, when I was a fresh-faced student, I was sponsored by a company called NEI Parsons. You can probably tell I'm from the northeast of England. And Parsons were a company that built large steam turbine generators for power stations. So a lot of the big power stations you see, like the Drax power station is a great example, that has NEI Parsons steam turbines in. They're huge. They're 660 megawatts each. They're phenomenal amounts of power. And I was sponsored by them through my university days, and I spent some time working there. But halfway through my my energy course, I studied electromechanical power engineering at Loughborough. And it was all geared towards the power industry. It's something I was very interested in. My family were involved in heavy engineering going back the years, and it was just something that I was always interested in, lots of big power projects. And but halfway through my course, I was given the option to extend it into a master's course that included for renewable energy. And I found it quite intriguing. And during those lectures, there was a chap, I don't know if you remember Jonathan Porritt, he used to head up Friends of the Earth. He became the environmental advisor to King Charles, as he is now. And he held some of those lectures, and he talked about the effect of power generation on the climate and the external costs associated with generation. So when you look at a coal station, you've got acid rain, you've got NOx fumes, you've got carbon dioxide. He talked about all of this, and it set the cogs whirring. And I found it really interesting. And I was quite lucky that as part of the same course, we could look into wind and we could look into solar. And really, it was that lecture from Jonathan Porritt that made me catch the bug, so to speak. And so when I was looking for my first job out of university, I went to Eastern Electricity because they had an expanding renewables team at the time. So it was, I went from dirty power to clean power during my student days.
But why wind, John? Because, look, I mean, I'll spare your blushes because I don't want you to have to blow your own trumpet. But of all the there's a lot of onshore wind, right? Mm. And I have it on a reliable authority that you've been involved with about the delivery of about 20% of it, which for one person is quite something in terms of everything that's been delivered. So you obviously caught the bug and caught it big.
Yeah.
Why wind?
At the time, looking at clean power generation, wind was the one that was starting to stand out. Certainly in the UK, we are blessed with 40% of Europe's wind. So we are very, very lucky in the UK to have more wind than any other country in Europe.
It's obviously something to do with the diet.
Clearly is. And more, we've got certainly a lot more wind than solar, than sunshine. And it was the technology that was really kicking off. And when I joined Eastern Electricity, it was only a small team. The company owned quite a substantial coal portfolio at the time. But we were asked to get to 10% renewable energy by 2010. So they wanted 10% of their portfolio to be purely powered by renewables, and wind at the time was the answer. So we spent our time from the Orkneys down to Devon and Cornwall looking and developing new wind farm sites. There weren't that many people doing it at the time, and we were quite lucky at the time to have a company that wanted to expand into renewables. But at the time, Eastern Electricity became part of Texas Utilities, and Texas Utilities then started moving away from renewable energy and actually pulled out of Europe in its entirety. So then I moved on to, it was the first private equity-backed renewable energy developer in the country called Your Energy, which we started with some colleagues from scratch, developing some, primarily to develop new wind farms. So we worked on large-scale wind farms across the country from first principles, so going out, finding the sites, talking to the landowners, looking to get grid connections, going through the planning process and eventually getting the sites up and running. But I always remember even my first day in renewables, and this was back in the Eastern Electricity days, the my boss at the time, a chap called Bill Richmond, and he's still very, very busy in wind. He said to me, forget everything that you know about engineering, everything that you know about wind energy. This is a political job. And every day in your career, it will be politics. And he was so right. I was so at the time I took it with a pinch of salt, but yeah, it is hugely political. And when we were developing those early wind farms, we would go into a planning committee to try and persuade the community it's a good idea. We'd probably spend about 70, 80% of our time talking about climate change and trying to convince people that climate change was real before we then go on to the fact that turbines do generate electricity. And it was always very difficult because it's very new, and there weren't many wind farms around. So people would say, well, yeah, how much energy do they generate? What happens when it's not windy? I've got this huge power station up the road here that generates everything. Why do we need this? And it was always an uphill struggle. And he was right. It was very, very political. And when you look at the sorts of things you need to do to develop a wind farm, you look at, you have landscape assessments, historic assessments, ecology, ornithology, aviation, telecoms, utilities, hydrology. There's a huge list of things you need to assess. Wow. It takes a long time. It can take 7 years from start to finish, which is a ridiculous amount of time. And but what we have seen, and what I'm really encouraged about, is despite it being a political job, I mean, we had an onshore wind ban from 2015 to 2022, a hugely political issue. But despite all of that, what I have noticed is when I speak with communities now, we don't have that climate change discussion anymore. That's gone. We don't even have the discussion about whether wind is worthwhile or not. That's addressed now. We actually find communities are more welcoming of the technology than they used to be. And it's really, really encouraging to see that. And I think as we become more used to seeing wind, it can only get better. So it's been an interesting journey. It's been a long journey, but a very, very interesting one.
Oh, sounds like it.
I don't very often get to speak to experts about this stuff, but I'm going to take this opportunity to ask a specific thing that has really bugged me for many, many years. We are an island nation.
Yes.
We are surrounded by water. We are full of rivers. Hydropower, tidal power, has the potential, in my simple head, to add to the mix for energy generation. But as a country, we don't seem to have embraced it in the way that we have wind. Why?
A lot of it has been around technology and getting the technology right. When you look at wave power, it's very difficult to have operating machinery and moving parts in the sea for a long time. It's hard to maintain. It's hard to get enough power out of it. And you also find that in the west side of the country has the best wave reaches compared to the east side of the country. But getting it to any form of scale is very difficult with enough power coming out of it. There have been some interesting tidal projects, and those tidal projects, big tidal lagoon projects, they would essentially turn the turbine as the tide is coming in into a reservoir, and then as the tide is going out, the water's released, and the turbine continues turning as the water's released. But those sorts of projects are hugely expensive on capital. You need to, huge lagoons to build in the estuaries to be able to do that. And I think a lot of the issues around that have been not just technology, but then there's an environmental issues of doing that, and then the investment issues you need. So I think it's a lot of it's very hard to kickstart. There are a lot of issues to address. There was a very good wave project a number of years ago called Limpet, and it was this turbine that was stuck on a rock in the northern Western Isles of Scotland, and that operated successfully for a while. But the problem is getting it on scale is a very yes. difficult thing to do, because right. there are only so many places you can put it, unfortunately.
I knew you'd have the answer. See, straight off the top of his head like that. Solve my problems. Come on, the wind. Let's have more wind.
Absolutely. Well, and on the subject of more wind, John, you skirted on this idea of the communities and building communities almost around a wind turbine. I've articulated this badly, probably, to friends of mine. I've got some friends of mine that do sort of geo. They assess the geography for putting in wind turbines, but under the sea, or in the sea. Yeah. So they sort of look at that. But anyway, I was talking to them and articulating this idea, and they love the idea. And my feeling is that people would love the idea of sticking a turbine much like the one you have behind you, although I suspect slightly bigger, in the middle of effectively a community of 500 houses and then, powering everything within that thing. Talk us through that concept and what that future might look like and how it benefits us.
Well, it's if you go back to how the electricity grid was first put together, towns used to have their own power stations, and they used to have every town would have a small power station. It was really in the 50s and 60s when the national grid was formed, and the whole point of that was to shunt large amounts of power from a centralized point through the wires to communities. What we find with renewables, where it's not developed on the scale of an offshore project, is that you can integrate that more into the local grids, so the smaller wires that you see crossing the landscape. And it's called embedded generation. And if I was to develop an ordinary wind farm, say a 2, 3, 4 turbine site on the edge of a town, I would plug that into the wooden pylons that you see crossing the landscape. So that's at 11 kV or 33 kV. And that means that that local area will primarily get its power from wind when it's windy. And when it's not windy, it will pull power in from the national grid as it does now. If you then move that to developing a new community, normally if you're looking to build a housing development, you'd apply to the DNO for a connection, and you'd wait however many years to get that. That connection can be quite chunky to power that number of homes. But if you can start saying, okay, well, if we use the space next to that community for renewable energy, then we can be softer on the grid connection. We can power that community first with the power that we have from the turbine. Anything that's extra, anything that's left over, goes into the local grid as it does now. And normally now, when you're developing a new community, you're looking at providing an amount of green space with that community. So, for example, the ones that we're doing, at least 50%, if not more, of the land around that community goes to green space. But if you can use that green space in tandem with wind, with energy, then you're getting energy, you're getting biodiversity net gain, you're getting open space for people to walk around in, and you're also getting power to them as well. And it helps you to get your development away quicker. You're not necessarily waiting as long for your grid connection. You're able to be more clever with your grid connection, and you're also potentially able to give the community themselves their own dedicated supply, which is what we're trying to achieve. So it's almost going back to where the industry started, where a town would have its own power station. We're now saying, well, why don't we have our own? And it could, but it can be renewable. And but there's no reason why, if I'm not developing a new community, if we're just developing a turbine, we could develop that turbine on the edge of a town that will primarily meet the needs of that town. It's a different mindset and a different way of looking at it. When I started in the industry, we always looked at turbine numbers. How many turbines can we squeeze into this site? What can we do for it? Now I'm more interested in looking at what's the demand of this particular area? What can we do to match that demand? Can we fit something that meets that and provides a benefit like EV charging? That's the sort of thing that I'm more interested in now. And yeah. So it's moving away from a utility style approach to a community style approach. It's looking at what is the needs of that population in the area. Can we supply it with renewable energy?
And how many turbines does it take to power, say, a 500 home community? I mean, or whatever the community is. 10? 20?
Oh, no, one. And that will have spare. The scheme that we're doing at the moment in Buckinghamshire, that has a single 4.5 megawatt turbine. That's enough for around 2,000 homes, and we're doing 500 wow. homes. So the excess goes into the grid. Now, what we also do alongside that is, and this is something that the UK needs to be cleverer at, is to maximise the connection that we have to its best potential. So that's why we develop solar with it as well. And if you have, say, a 5-6 megawatt connection for your wind, there's no reason why you couldn't develop anything up to 10 megawatts of solar alongside that, but then be very clever with your control system so that you're maximizing your output into the grid at all times using that connection most efficiently. And at the moment, the way that the grid is structured and the way the projects are structured, generally you book your capacity, you reserve your capacity, and that technology spits down that wire and that's it. It's much better to coordinate things together. And the neat thing about wind and solar is they complement each other as well. So in the summer months, you normally find during the day, the wind might drop as the sun picks up. So the two technologies match each other really, really well. And then you normally find on the summer's evening, the breeze picks up as the sun goes down. It works together really well and complements each other really well. And then throw a few batteries in there and you're very less reliant on the grid.
He's good. Brilliant. Isn't he? I mean, the thing is, John, you are a bit of a boffin. Let's be honest. Your brain is phenomenal. And what is quite normal is that boffins are rubbish at explaining themselves in words of one syllable so that idiots like me can understand. And I'm sitting here listening to you talking, understanding every single word you're saying, and understanding.
I'm glad you say that. My colleague, Rachel, always tells me when I'm speaking to anyone about anything I do, to think about the language of a bright 9-year-old and to say it in that way. And I try my best, but sometimes, particularly when it gets gritty, it can go off on a tangent and feel like.
What you remind me of is my childhood and a man called Sir Clive Sinclair. And I don't know if people will be familiar with Sir Clive Sinclair.
I remember the C5.
The C5, exactly. So this was my first experience of what was an electric vehicle back in the day. Yeah. The Sinclair C5, look it up on Google and look up Sir Clive Sinclair if you haven't heard of him. And then have a look at John speaking about wind here, and you get the sense that here is an incredibly intelligent human being who is able to speak a very complex language and explain things in a way which is so simple to understand and makes you want to learn from them. Clive changed my life in that I actually found engineering science suddenly attractive. Do you do outreach work with communities where you go and explain stuff to kids to enthuse them about your expertise?
Probably not as often as I should. I was at Oxford Brookes. I go there every year and talk with the urban design students there about what we do. So I was there a couple of weeks ago, which was good. But we do sometimes have local scout groups and groups like that come to see us at wind farms and talk them through how it works. I remember a few years ago, I took a group of Cub Scouts to a wind turbine. It wasn't my wind turbine either, and I had the door open. I was showing them around, and the emergency stop button, this bright red button, was right at a height of an 8.5-year-old in the fear that was going through my mind at the time. But it's so important to inspire the next generation. And it was quite good at when we went to the Everything Electric show at Farnborough.
Yeah,
there was a family who came to see us, and instantly this young lad, he must have been about 9 or 10, said, "Daddy, that's my turbine." And there's a picture of our double archers and Chetley Wood machine stand, and he said, "Daddy, that's my turbine." And he's like, it was really good to see, because people do identify with the turbine in their local area. And in this case, where these machines are, there is one of our new developments is next door, and as you walk around the development, you see the turbine, you know where the power is. It was good to see.
Do you get emotional? I love a car, and cars get names, and I do treat them like people almost. Do you get that way with turbines?
You do. It really is a beautiful thing when you switch it on for the first time and it keeps on going, but it is a wonderful thing. And one of the first sites I worked on has been taken down now, and I was absolutely gutted. It was taken down and replaced with a new one, but I was still thinking, oh, blimey, that was one of my first sites. It was a strange thing to see.
Do you name them?
We do here. Our current turbine, we call her Willow. I think it was because it was very wet when we built her, and Willow grows very well in wet things.
Wind in the willows. I love it.
I'm trying to think. Our double archers turbine, we've called her Daisy. We have a turbine on a former coal mine, so we called her Ash. But the next one,
I noticed,
promised the competition for the next one, I think.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
But I noticed, John, that they're called her.
Well,
they're a her rather than a him.
Yeah, it's a funny thing. It's always, oh, there she goes, and it's always associate them with as a her. I don't know why.
Would Rachel make the same assumption? So we know Rachel. So
this is a trap. It's a trap. Don't answer. No comment. It's a trap.
I think I speak on behalf of Rachel, is my is our comms director, and I think that she would be the same. She'd say her as well, without a doubt.
Okay. It's just curious, isn't it? It's curious the things that we do without really thinking about them.
That's pretty
cool. I had a really good question, which I've completely forgotten now, because I'm a wally.
Whilst you're thinking, when you were at school, John, what did you want to do? What was the big idea?
It was always something in engineering. And my dad worked in near to the ship. Well, he did his apprenticeship in the shipyards in Newcastle. My granddad was a chief engineer in the in the boats. He was in the Atlantic Fleet. So it's engineering's always been something in the family blood, I think. And so it was always that, and which is why I ended up working at NEI Parsons. It's where my dad did his apprenticeship, so I ended up sort of starting off where he did, and But I obviously went a different way, away from the away from steam turbines to wind turbines. But it was always something that was in my blood. And going back to when I mentioned my first boss saying it's a political job, you find that you do less and less engineering as the years go on, more and more on the planning, more and more on the development side. So trying to get sites through planning, I ended up going for, and I would chart a town planner of all things, because I felt I needed to understand more and learn more about the planning process and how to take projects through planning. So planning and politics and engineering kind of have all morphed into one thing. So it's a really odd job when people say, what do you do? It's a very difficult thing to describe sometimes, because there are just so many elements to it. And the one thing I would say is the EV world is fabulous, and getting to understand and getting to know that has been a really, really rewarding part of my more recent job. And understanding the technicalities behind charging, how it works, what it means when you plug your car in, that it's not that simple as filling it up with petrol. It's been fascinating, and it's a wonderful industry to be part of.
It is, and you'll be very pleased to know that I've remembered what I was thinking a moment or two ago. But first of all, I cannot help but laugh slightly at the name NEI Parsons.
Yeah,
because it sounds like somebody with a bit of a lazy eye. You know, you just look at them and any eye will do.
It
you know,
so Northern Engineering Industries. So
there you go. Far more sensible.
yeah. There was Parsons who built steam turbines. There was Rearol that built switchgear, electrical switchgear. It was all linked together in the power sector. But yeah, it's
perfect. Well, it'll always make me smile for very schoolboy reasons. But anyway, John, there are a number of myths, just like in the same way that we have myths in the EV industry and vehicles and stuff like that. But of course, I mean, every wind time that the turbine that goes up kills an enormous amount of birds, is incredibly noisy, and there's probably other things. What are the things that you hear, and what are the answers to those questions? So first of all, it kills loads of birds and is terrible for the environment, as in the local ecology. Come on. Mm.
It's always been the case. I mean, since I started, all of these various things have been discussed and thrown at me. From a bird's perspective, when we design a site and when we start and look at a site, we'll normally do at least a year's worth, if not more, of bird surveys to understand what's going on in the area and what there is. But what you tend to find is, in day to day, it's very, very rare that you'd have a bird collision with a turbine. When you speak with RSPB as a consultee, they normally feed into the planning process. They're often worried about displacing populations. So if you've got ground nesting birds, for example, is there a time when you're putting up something new in the field would cause them to move on? Would they move away from the area? And as we've learned more about wind, and as birds have learned more about wind, you tend to find those populations where they are displaced come back. You find that that it's very, very rare that you see an issue with birds and turbines, but it's all about putting things in the right place. So there are ways and means of developing that would be wrong. There's no reason why birds and turbines can't live together. It's the same with bats. We do a lot of bat surveys around sites, but there is very good bat guidance and a lot of research that shows where you should put turbines, near to hedgerows or not near to hedgerows. So there were some genuine concerns that people used to raise, but as we've learned more, it's clear that they have been addressed. Noise is one where people will naturally say it's going to be noisy, it's going to cause a problem. When we design a site, we carry out background noise surveys in the area, but we correlate that with wind speeds. So we have a good idea of how background noise in an area changes with wind speed. And we then map the turbine noise onto that. And we have guidance that we have to adhere to, which essentially ensures that nobody will experience a noise nuisance at any nearby dwelling. And we have to be, we're very, very careful about that, because if we were to cause a problem, the planning authorities could shut us down. And if they shut us down for more than 6 months, we have to take them away. So we have to do our homework correctly, and we have to cite them properly in order to be okay. But you do find that in people's hearts of hearts, when people used to object vociferously to wind, a lot of it was visual. It's the fact that you're changing a landscape. There's something there that wasn't, and is that an acceptable thing to do? And at the end of the day, it's a balance. Do we want power? Do we want energy? How are we going to achieve that? How would that landscape look if we kept the status quo and climate change kicked in to the level that it could kick in? If we don't do anything about it, that landscape will probably change in a completely different way. So it's about balance and understanding. But we there's a lot that's been thrown at me over the years, and I had one public exhibition I attended on a site years ago. You could see potentially the wind farm that I was developing from the entrance to a large private school. You couldn't see it from the school, you couldn't see from the grounds of the school, but you could see it from the entrance. And I had somebody come up to me in the public exhibition saying, "Well, how could you possibly do this? What's the problem? How will my son learn French? He'll not be able to learn French if there's a if there's a wind farm visible from the school." Wow. I did have a point. I mean, I can't speak a word of French, and I've been working.
Well, there you go. Point proven. Oh, dear. Amazing.
John, how do you keep your sense of humour? You're somebody I've met, I'm lucky enough to have met face to face, and you are always positive, always laughing, always looking at the funny side of the bright side of life. Yet you carry on your shoulders huge responsibilities to deliver not only clean energy, but engineering projects which are safe and are bringing benefit to not just those immediately connected, but in a wider sense. How do you balance those things? Is it just natural? Is it who you are?
It's mainly, and it's, I could say the same for the rest of the team who work here as well. I love what I do, and my colleagues love what I do. Love what they do. Sorry,
there's a point. Oh, that's getting snipped. John said this.
All my colleagues love what they do. We all love our jobs. We all love trying to achieve a clean energy future, and it's what makes us tick. And when you love your job, naturally you're always looking for solutions, and you're always looking for the best ways of getting to that end point. It's the same with you guys. I mean, with EV Cafe, I mean, you all very, very clearly love what you do, and when that happens, it shines, and it helps you deliver.
That's very kind, but then I lose my patience at times. You know, I get ratty about stuff. Paul, he's very passionate about what he does, but gets a little, you know, under the collar.
Ratty.
What boils your blood? What gets you really frustrated?
Oh my goodness, that's a good question.
You can't be perfect.
Oh Lord, no.
Yeah, your team know that as well.
Yeah. Do now.
I'm going to have to think about that one. I'm sure my colleagues could tell me what boils my blood, but I guess projects can sometimes be really frustrating to deliver, and there are huge hurdles. I mean, I've heard on other members on the podcast talking about things such as grid connections and the difficulty that you sometimes face with sites. That can obviously cause frustrations and cause concerns, but you need to look at ways around it. You can't just stop.
Is that an engineering mindset that you see a problem as a way of finding the solution, and that's your mission? It's not about the instant emotional rage about the problem. It's where's the solution, and I'm going to find it.
Yeah. I guess the other thing. Yeah, that's right. But I guess the other thing that boils my blood is when I know, for example, when I'm talking about wind or solar or anything, I know that it works, and I know I can read the meter. I can see how much power it produces. There are occasions when you sit back and you watch the news and you look at what may be happening overseas, where people are saying, "Oh well, we need to drill more or do this or do that," and you're thinking, it's such a shame because we know that it works, and I find it frustrating that the green economy has so much it can deliver in terms of jobs, in terms of clean air, in terms of prosperity, and there are political blockers, I guess, that happen that do get in the way. That's probably what makes my blood boil, and I just have to change channel and listen to something instead.
That's a very logical response. I usually just chuck something at the telly.
I've decided to stop doing that now. I've decided when I hear crazy political things turn up, I now try and wait 4 days before forming an opinion, because generally 4 days later something's changed.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah. Yeah, in fairness, yeah, that would be true of the current scenarios. Anyway, John, so we do have a little tradition on this year's show we do, and that is to hand you the magic wand. Uh-huh. So this is a magic wand. So you can see just here it has a little lightning bolt. It's been crafted by 3D... genius, clever stuff. I always find these things really clever, but anyway, it is perfectly magic, and I get to hand it to you now. So here we go. There, you can take the magic wand, and now you have to use it responsibly for one wish.
God,
what is your one wish, John?
Well, I'm very lucky because I've listened to your previous podcasts, obviously.
Ah, you were ready for it, you cheat.
I know that others have asked for some of the things on my wish list, such as grid connections. And there was a great one about decisions being made, understanding the impacts of decisions being made. I think it was Professor, was it Richard Dallin?
Yes.
Yes. Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to go for, I'd like people to champion positive change. And that's my wish, that people champion positive change. In the climate change, the climate emergency, everything that's happening around that, obviously that's negative change. But there are things that we can do about it. And real things that we can do about it. We can embrace onshore wind, we can embrace solar, we can embrace the transition to EV. But we do see, I mean, for example, it was last month, we had the best EV sales record, I think, ever in March. And yet the next day in some of the newspapers, they were talking about, oh, do people really want to go to EV and why? There's no reason for that. We need to embrace positive change, and we need to champion that moving forward. And I know that you guys do that wonderful job in EV, and it is such an important thing to do. And I think as humanity, if we were able to embrace and champion positive change more, we could get to our goals a lot quicker. We're very good at wrecking the environment very quickly, but we're also very good at coming up with solutions and innovative solutions to getting around problems. And I think that if we were to embrace that and champion that, we could get to those solutions a lot quicker than we have been. And so that would be my wish.
Absolutely right. Very good.
JC, he's not bad. You warned me not to gush. right at the beginning of it's proving incredibly difficult. I've got two things that I think I should say in summary. One is that the stage upon which you work, John, needs to be a damn sight bigger, because your impact is phenomenal and you have the ability to inspire a generation to make a difference. I also don't really believe in the honours system. However, give that man a knighthood, because my lordy, what a dude. What an absolute dude. I think you are phenomenal.
Everything that I do is all part of a team. It's all part of a wider team that are delivering. I'm just a cog in that team.
You know what? Great leaders say that. Great leaders always say that. You know, I'm part of a team and all that stuff. We've been talking to you, my friend, and all I can tell you is that I'm buzzing. I want to go and engineer some stuff.
Well, I, on the other hand, the only reason I've had John on there is because I want to get to the top of a turbine at some point. So he needs to
please
send
make
me
that
out.
Happen.
We must sort that out.
I'll tell you what, if I had a magic wand, he'd be off the top of that for doing turbine.
John, genuinely, it is a real pleasure to have been able to kind of get some of this articulated. I fear we've only scratched the surface, and we, you know, we've not made you cry or anything. I mean, it's just, that's very disappointing. but it is really important to see everything that you're doing and what you stand for and what your team are delivering, and just really celebrate that, because the ideas are genius. You know, we're looking at what we could possibly see as the first directly wired to a turbine charging infrastructure, the first directly wired Starbucks. It could be possibly the world's first off-grid Starbucks? I'm not sure. Maybe.
Possibly, yes. I mean, it has backup, but it probably is.
Well, Yeah. So, I mean, these are amazing potential world firsts, and communities are going to benefit. The globe is going to benefit. The grid is going to benefit. There are so many benefits. And as John has pointed out, you bring it in such a way that is endearing and people want to get on board. And, you know, you are your own magic wand in this instance, because I think you trigger people positively embracing change, the change that you advocate. I'm very, very confident that we're going to see some amazing change coming from AW Energy Group, part of the Arnold White Group. It's going to be pretty, pretty exciting future. And we get to follow along with you. That's super cool.
Well, we see you as an integral part of what we do. I mean, it's, When we look at the learning curve that we've been through on EV charging, it's huge, and it needs industry leaders such as yourself to help us navigate those waters, because it is a challenge getting to understand the technology and how it works. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, we accept. we accept joining you on the journey. That's going to be great. Well, we look forward to this and more of it. Well, I'm sure we'll hear more from you. This may come out after the CV show, but you'll have been speaking at the CV show, which will have been amazing. So we'll say well done for doing that, because that's probably in the past now. But there we go. But I'm sure many people will get lots of opportunities to hear much more from John Fairley. And it's been a delight. John,
thank you.
I presume you are on LinkedIn, aren't you? We know that. So,
I am.
You know, we can point people, if you want to learn more, follow John and the team at Arnold. I think you're on there as Arnold White Group, aren't you?
Yeah.
That's your LinkedIn follow. So people can follow Arnold White Group and the innovative things that you guys are doing. And of course, if you want to hear more podcasts just like this, you can either do it on Apple and Spotify and all those kinds of things. You can leave reviews there too. You know, you can just kind of go 5 stars. John was brilliant. I'm inspired. I'm going off to blow wind or do something. But you can also listen to lots of other podcasts. There's some really good ones. I'm not sure there's many better than John, but anyway, there we go. Do follow on with the Evie Cafe. Connect with us on LinkedIn and YouTube and all of those wonderful places. But in the meantime, thanks ever so much for joining us again. And we look forward to the next one.
Thank you.
Have a great day, everybody.
See you soon.